Ever since her novel Housekeeping was published in 1980, Marilynne Robinson has been admired for her luminous prose and her sharp mind. Her latest book, When I Was a Child, I Read Books, is a collection of essays on topics ranging from Calvinism to austerity to cosmology. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Ms. Robinson has won a Pulitzer Prize for her second novel, Gilead, which was followed by Home. She's also published the nonfiction books Mother Country, The Death of Adam, and Absence of Mind. I'm very pleased to welcome Marilynne Robinson back to our show. Hello.
Thank you. Hello.
Novelists rarely write books like this anymore. It's a very strenuous scholarly work in which you focus on cultural issues by bringing up the Bible, human nature, faith. What inspired you to start exploring these topics?
They've always interested me. I can't find a beginning for them, you know. The collection is actually, for the most part, lectures that I have given in various places. And perhaps to some degree they're suited to audiences that I've had, you know.
Did you determine the topics of the lectures, or were you asked to do a lecture on Calvinism, for example?
No, I have not been asked to do a lecture on Calvinism. Anybody who
although
wants
you might
one,
have been
I'm having,
predestined to do one.
I could very well have been. It feels like that sometimes. No, the one lecture on Moses and American liberalism, that was for a prize in Reform theology that I got from Princeton. And so I felt very much invited to talk about Calvinism there.
Well, it's interesting. You write a lot about religion here. And when I talked to you at an earlier time about Housekeeping, and I asked you about the influence of the Bible on that book, you said that you were totally unaware of it at the time.
That's true.
Is it always there in the back of your head?
I think it probably is. You know, I mean, it's just, I think it's wonderful when there's a beautiful primary literature that you really are exposed to through the length of your life. I think that creates a sort of resonance that is invaluable, really.
So was the Bible one of the first books you read?
Yes, yes. Although I can't claim to have read it, you know, read around in it, certainly.
But many writers talk about how the language, the King James Version, has had a real impact on the way they even thought about literature.
Mm-hmm. I think
and
that's
the stories.
Been true. I think that's been true since the early English language translations appeared, which, you know, by the grace of God, I suppose, are really beautiful characteristically and have done a great deal to enrich the language.
Well, you begin with a long quotation from Walt Whitman, who wrote, "America, if eligible at all to downfall and ruin, is eligible within herself, not without." And then he goes on to say, "America, it may be, is doing very well upon the whole, notwithstanding these antics of the parties and their leaders, the half-brained nominees, the many ignorant ballots, and many elected failures and blatherers." He wrote that in 1870. When you read it, did you think, gee, he wrote that yesterday?
It seems like that, and it's very reassuring to know that we have survived exactly that problem, you know, that there is a world beyond the blatherers and the ignorant ballots.
Well, the notion that America's in decline has been around for a long time. Do you think that it is in decline now, or are we just going through another one of the cycles?
Oh, I don't think we're in decline. I don't think we need to be in decline. I think it's the idea of decline, for some reason, is very fascinating to many cultures, and it's had huge impact because it makes people desperate. It frightens them, and it makes them feel that the culture that they live in is an antagonist, you know? And so I think that on the one hand, there's always the feeling of decline, and on the other hand, it can self-fulfill. It can become the thing itself if people allow themselves to, you know, to entertain, you know, ill-considered hostilities and so on the basis of it.
Well, over my lifetime, the fall of the Roman Empire has been invoked in discussions of the Soviet Union, Japan, more recently China.
Yes.
I'm guessing. Oh, somebody said a united Europe.
Exactly. The Pacific Rim countries. I mean, and the thing that bothers me is that not only does that make us sort of contemptuous of our own civilization in ways that are not healthy, but it also makes us inappropriately the antagonists of other countries that are doing well.
For a time. Then Japan had its own problems.
Exactly. Like, you know,
Soviet Union fell.
Exactly, exactly. And I don't know, this idea that our primary objective should be to anticipate hostility in other people, which is basically a norm for talking about foreign policy now, that makes us very irrational and dangerous, I think.
Well, has it changed now when the threat is from terrorism? It's not from some huge economic power like the Soviet Union or China?
Well, you know, well, these things compound each other. But I also think that the Red Scare kind of resembles the terrorist thing, you know, where in the name of, you know, of sustaining a democratic society, you do undemocratic things. And that is the danger when we lose composure.
It's hard to read this book and not think of the stump speeches that Mitt Romney and Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich have been giving on the campaign trail and the current political discourse in general. Obviously, you wrote most of these pieces before the current primary race even took off, but is the kind of political rhetoric about religion and society, about the role of government, about personal freedom and the free market, what got you thinking about the topics you chose to write about here?
In many cases, yes. And these things, they're very, very overt now, but they've been simmering in the culture for a long time. This drawing of lines and saying the people on the other side are the enemies of the American way of life and all this sort of thing. And oddly,
not just the other side, Americans themselves. I mean,
that's what I mean, exactly.
The other party.
Yes, yes, and liberal professors in secular universities like me, you know, are supposed to be some sort of hostile force. I have heard people from other parts of the country talk about the liberal conspiracy to ban the Bible or something, you know. I mean, these amazing things. And they believe that functions for them as truth, you know.
Do you think American society is being increasingly defined by economics?
I think that definition has definitely been pushed on us. The idea that it's like primitive capitalism, like, you know, Britain in the 19th century, where the patriotic duty of workers is to work a lot and earn very little.
But there is this notion that the foundation of the United States is capitalism, that our culture and government is designed to support it. That couldn't have been the case when the country was founded, because capitalism really was in its infancy, if at all.
Well, I think that Britain and Europe at that time could fairly be described as capitalist in many ways. I mean, for example, the slave trade, which was centered in Europe and Britain, was part of a huge industrial enterprise that grew cotton in the American South. Basically, slavery was like the ideal capitalist worker system, you know, in that time before the political and cultural modifications that created what we've known.
And then in the midst of that, or pretty much following that, the unfettered capitalism that began in the middle of the 19th century is what made America world power. So
I don't know.
Well, we built the railroads, we built our steel mills, we started doing all the things that have made this country. We had the cotton mills, whatever, all the things that made this country an economic power in the world.
Well, you know, I think that what made us an economic power was that we did in fact trammel our capitalism to a certain, you know, that we did bring it under a degree of social and political control. The wealth of this country has been based, as Walt Whitman points out, on the very broad distribution of wealth. And it was restraining capitalism that created the broad distribution of wealth. And that's, as it reemerges in these highly consolidated forms, there is an ebbing away of wealth from the general population.
I'm talking with Marilyn Robinson about her latest book, which is a collection of essays called When I Was a Child, I read books published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. You write, I'm quoting, "In my Bible, Jesus does not say, 'I was hungry and you fed me,' though not in such a way as to interfere with free market principles." Well, you live in Iowa, which is a religious and fairly politically conservative state. Christianity has historically concerned itself with the poor. Do you see that changing in discussions with your neighbors?
Certainly not. Not in discussions with my neighbors, but...
You're in Ames, which is probably not typical
Iowa City. Actually.
Oh, Iowa. Well, yeah. Is that typical of Iowa?
Less typical than Ames, perhaps. But, but you know, you have to remember, Iowa created Obama, in effect. You know, he won the caucuses there, and he won the presidential election in Iowa. It's not... It might be a purple state sometimes, and sometimes it's a blue state. It's not, and it has, we have, in my opinion, not the greatest legislature at the moment, but it has a very progressive history.
Well, what do you see as the relationship between politics and religion? Is the politics influencing the way we talk about religion today, or is religion influencing the way we talk about politics?
Well, you know, it seems to me as if there's a kind of religion, which I do not consider necessary or identical with any version of religion, that has this sort of, it seems to me, kind of a damned versus saved worldview. And this has been kind of opportunistically associated with political stances, you know. So that if you are of, you know, there, these things have been packaged. So the assumption is that if you are religious, then you are also opposed to food stamps or something, you know, which is perfectly arbitrary and bizarre.
Well, hasn't the way religion is practiced in this country changed? Mainstream churches are losing members, but other kinds of religion, the smaller ones, or the actually sometimes the mega churches and the evangelical churches are gaining. So is the emphasis on religion shifting in this country?
There's no question that religious culture in the country has changed dramatically in the last 30 or 40 years. I think part of it is that the, you know, the intellectual traditions of American religion have been substantially abandoned. And that, you know, that it's difficult. It's, you know, it's hard to be initiated into things that are written to complicate and humble your moral sense and so on. And in the absence of that, I think religion has become, to some extent, a caricature of itself.
Well, we hear on places like Fox that there's a war on religion.
Exactly.
And we people don't say Happy Holidays instead of Merry Christmas, which is an indication of just how far things have declined. And there's a debate over the founders' ideas about freedom of religion and separation of church and state.
That's very hard to understand. I mean, the King George was the head of the Church of England. There was an utter fusion of church and state. And the revolutionaries were separating themselves from England in all sorts of important institutional ways. And one of them was that they did not want religious affiliation to be identical with national membership or participation. You know, it had been true, it was true at the time of the Revolution, that if you were a Quaker or a Catholic in England, you had very limited property rights and very, very radically limited political rights. And that's exactly what they wanted to defuse, you know, the possibility that any religious culture could negotiate civil rights.
The early states, to some degree, were created by people searching for religious freedoms, even
Absolutely.
People who broke off from other groups that had searched, that had
yes.
hoped for religious freedom.
Yes.
So we have Roger Williams leaving Massachusetts because he feels persecuted.
Exactly.
You're clearly a religious person. But you say you work for a secular university. Do you see any war going on between religiosity and secularism?
The disrespect in that formulation of war on religion. I mean, I live in a secular, you know, environment professionally. I cross the street to a church. Who is in the church? a lot of professors, you know, who honor the secular traditions of the university and practice religious faith simultaneously. This is no problem. The thing that I love about a secular environment is everyone feels equally at home. People don't go around with any kind of exclusive identity on their sleeves. I don't need people around reinforcing me in what I believe. I feel that I kind of know.
You describe yourself as a Calvinist. Now, there aren't too many Calvinists around. To me, Calvinism means predestination. Am I limiting my perception of Calvinism?
Yes. it's a vast and very brilliant theology that has had many, many social consequences in America and anywhere else, affected. It's in many ways, it was certainly the first religious tradition that could be called a liberal tradition. You know, they permitted divorce, for example. They banned death penalty for religious nonconformity, all sorts of things like that simply didn't occur elsewhere, you know?
A lot of this book is about human nature and what it means to be human. Does writing essays like this help you figure that out and explain it to others? Or I would assume fiction would also serve that function for you.
I'm very interested in being human.
Some of my best friends are.
I know that I've used up a lot of my opportunity to explore the experience, but the two parts of it that really fascinate me are the sensation of inwardness, the feeling of thought and sensation, and then on the other hand, the fact that I understand myself as being somehow created out of civilization. That in order to find the Ariadne thread that would lead me to understand myself runs through Constantinople, you know?
The title of the book is When I Was a Child, I Read Books. What books did you read? And how does that apply to what we've been discussing?
Well, you know, I've read more than my share of Edgar Allan Poe. I've memorized a good deal of it. I read Willa Cather. I read, the books like The Yearling and so on. Really, it's a beautiful book. My mother read things like Edward Lear's poetry and so on. It was kind of randomly high quality.
And it made you who you are today.
It did indeed.
Marilynne Robinson is the author of the novels Housekeeping, Gilead, and also Home, and three books of nonfiction, Mother Country, The Death of Adam, and Absence of Mind. Now a fourth book of nonfiction, a collection of essays called When I Was a Child, I Read Books. It's published by Farris, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Pleasure again.